Gentlewomen of the jury, bear with me. Allow me to take just a tiny bit of your precious time. So this was le grand moment. I had left my Lolita, still sitting on the edge of the abysmal bed, drowsily raising her foot, fumbling at her shoelaces, and showing as she did so the nether side of her thigh up to the crotch of her panties. She had always been singularly absent-minded, or shameless, or both, in matters of leg show. This, then, was the hermetic vision of her which I had locked in, after satisfying myself that the door carried no inside bolt. The key, with its numbered dangler of carved wood, became forthwith the weighty sesame to a rapturous and formidable future. It was mine. It was part of my hot, hairy fist. In a few minutes, say 20, say half an hour, sicker ist sicker, as my Uncle Gustav used to say, I would let myself into that 342 and find my nymphet, my beauty and bride, imprisoned in her crystal sleep. Jurors, if my happiness could have talked, it would have filled that genteel hotel with a deafening roar. And my only regret today is that I did not quietly deposit key 342 at the office and leave the town, the country, the continent, the hemisphere, indeed the globe, that very same night. Let me explain. I was not unduly disturbed by her self-accusatory innuendos. I was still firmly resolved to pursue my policy of sparing her purity by operating only in the stealth of night, only upon a completely anaesthetized little nude. Restraint and reverence were still my motto, even if that purity, incidentally thoroughly debunked by modern science, had been slightly damaged through some juvenile erotic experience, no doubt homosexual, at that accursed camp of hers. Of course, in my old-fashioned, old-world way, I, Jean-Jacques Humbert, had taken for granted when I first met her that she was as unravished as the stereotypical notion of a normal child had been since the lamented end of the ancient world B.C. and its fascinating practices. We are not surrounded in our enlightened era by little slave flowers that can be casually plucked between business and bath, as they used to be in the days of the Romans. And we do not, as dignified Orientals did in still more luxurious times, use tiny entertainers fore and aft between the mutton and the rose sherbet. The whole point is that the old link between the adult world and the child world has been completely severed nowadays by new customs and new laws. Despite my having dabbled in psychiatry and social work, I really knew very little about children. After all, Lolita was only 12, and no matter what concessions I made to time and place, even bearing in mind the crude behaviour of American schoolchildren, I still was under the impression that whatever went on among those brash brats went on at a later age and in a different environment. Therefore, to retrieve the thread of this exploration, the moralist in me bypassed the issue by clinging to conventional notions of what 12-year-old girls should be. The child therapist in me, a fake, as most of them are, but no matter, regurgitated neo-Freudian hash and conjured up a dreaming and exaggerating dolly in the latency period of girlhood. Finally, the sensualist in me, a great and insane monster, had no objection to some depravity in his prey. But somewhere behind the raging bliss, bewildered shadows conferred. And not to have heeded them, this is what I regret. Human beings, attend! I should have understood that Lolita had already proved to be something quite different from innocent Annabelle, and that the nymphian evil breathing through every pore of the fey child that I had prepared for my secret delectation would make the secrecy impossible and the delectation lethal. I should have known, by the signs made to me by something in Lolita, the real child Lolita or some haggard angel behind her back, that nothing but pain and horror would result from the expected rapture. Oh, winged gentleman of the jury! And she was mine. She was mine. The key was in my fist was in my pocket, she was mine. In the course of the evocations and schemes to which I had dedicated so many insomnias, I had gradually eliminated all the superfluous blur, and by stacking level upon level of translucent vision had evolved a final picture. Naked, except for one sock and her charm bracelet, spread-eagled on the bed where my filter had felled her, so I foreglimpsed her. A velvet hair ribbon was still clutched in her hand. Her honey-brown body, with the white negative image of a rudimentary swimsuit patterned against her tan, presented to me its pale breast buds in rosy lamplight. A little pubic floss glistened on its plump hillock. The cold key with its warm wooden addendum was in my pocket. I wandered through various public rooms, glory below, gloom above. For the look of lust always is gloomy. Lust is never quite sure, even when the velvety victim is locked up in one's dungeon, that some rival devil or influential god may not still abolish one's prepared triumph. In common parlance, I needed a drink. But there was no barroom in that venerable place full of perspiring Philistines and period objects. I drifted to the men's room. There, a person in clerical black, a hearty party, commandee, checking with the assistance of Vienna if it was still there, inquired me how I'd like Dr. Boyd's talk, and looked puzzled when I, King Sigmund II, said Boyd was quite a boy, upon which I neatly chucked the tissue paper I had been wiping my sensitive fingertips with into the receptacle provided for it and sallied lobbywood. Comfortably resting my elbows on the counter, I asked Mr. Potts was he quite sure my wife had not telephoned. And what about that cot? He answered she had not, she was dead, of course, and the cot would be installed tomorrow if we decided to stay on. From a big crowded place called the Hunter's Hall came a sound of many voices discussing horticulture or eternity. Another room, called the Raspberry Room, all bathed in light, with bright little tables, and a large one with refreshments, was still empty except for a hostess, that type of worn woman with a glassy smile and Charlotte's manner of speaking. She floated up to me to ask if I was Mr. Braddock, because if so, Miss Beard had been looking for me. What a name for a woman, I said, and strolled away. In and out of my heart flowed my rainbow blood. I would give her till 9:30. Going back to the lobby, I found there a change. A number of people in floral dresses or black cloth had formed little groups here and there, and some elfish chance offered me the sight of a delightful child of Lolita's age, in Lolita's type of frock, but pure white. And there was a white ribbon in her black hair. She was not pretty, but she was a nymphette, and her ivory-pale legs and lily neck formed for one memorable moment a most pleasurable antiphony, in terms of spinal music, to my desire for Lolita, brown and pink, flushed and fouled. The pale child noticed my gaze, which was really quite casual and debonair, and being ridiculously self-conscious, lost countenance completely, rolling her eyes and putting the back of her hand to her cheek and pulling at the hem of her skirt and finally turning her thin mobile shoulder blades to me in specious chat with her cow-like mother. I left the loud lobby and stood outside on the white steps looking at the hundreds of powdered bugs wheeling around the lamps in the soggy black night, full of ripple and stir. All I would do, all I would dare to do, would amount to such a trifle. Suddenly I was aware that in the darkness next to me there was somebody sitting in a chair on the pillared porch. I could not really see him, but what gave him away was the rasp of a screwing off, then a discreet gurgle, then the final note of a placid screwing on. I was about to move away when his voice addressed me. "Where the devil did you get her? I beg your pardon?" I said, "The weather's getting better." "Seems so." "Who's the lassie?" "My daughter." "You lie, she's not." "I beg your pardon?" "I said your lie was hot." "Where's her mother?"
"Dead."
"I see, sorry. By the way, why don't you two lunch with me tomorrow? That dreadful crowd will be gone by then." "We'll be gone too." "Good night." "Sorry, I'm pretty drunk. Good night." "That child of yours needs lots of sleep. Sleep as a rose, as the Persians say." "Smoke?"
Not now."
He struck a light. But because he was drunk, or because the wind was, the flame illumined not him but another person, a very old man, one of those permanent guests of old hotels, and his white rocker. Nobody said anything, and the darkness returned to its initial place. Then I heard the old-timer cough and deliver himself of some sepulchral mucus. I left the porch. At least 30 minutes in all had elapsed. I ought to have asked for a sip. The strain was beginning to tell. If a violin string can ache, then I was that string. But it would have been unseemly to display any hurry. As I made my way through a constellation of fixed people in one corner of the lobby, there came a blinding flash, and beaming Dr. Braddock, two orchid-ornamentalized matrons, the small girl in white, and presumably the bared teeth of Humbert Humbert, sidling between the bride-like lassie and the enchanted cleric, were immortalized, insofar as the texture and print of small-town newspapers can be deemed immortal. A twittering group had gathered near the elevator. I again chose the stairs. 342 was near the fire escape. One could still, but the key was already in the lock, and then I was in the room. The door of the lighted bathroom stood ajar. In addition to that, a skeleton glow came through the Venetian blind from the outside arc lights. These intercrossed rays penetrated the darkness of the bedroom and revealed the following situation. Clothed in one of her old nightgowns, my Lolita lay on her side with her back to me, in the middle of the bed. Her lightly veiled body and bare limbs formed a Z. She had put both pillows under her dark tousled head. A band of pale light crossed her top vertebrae. I seemed to have shed my clothes and slipped into pajamas with the kind of fantastic instantaneousness which is implied when in a cinematographic scene the process of changing is cut, and I had already placed my knee on the edge of the bed when Lolita turned her head and stared at me through the striped shadows. Now this was something the intruder had not expected. The whole pill-spiel, rather a sordid affair, entre nous soit dit, had had for object a fastness of sleep that a whole regiment would not have disturbed. And here she was, staring at me, and thickly calling me Barbara. Barbara, wearing my pyjamas, which were much too tight for her, remained poised motionless over the little sleep-talker. Softly, with a hopeless sigh, Dolly turned away, resuming her initial position. For at least 2 minutes I waited and strained on the brink, like that tailor with his homemade parachute 40 years ago when about to jump from the Eiffel Tower. Her faint breathing had the rhythm of sleep. Finally, I heaved myself onto my narrow margin of bed, stealthily pulled at the odds and ends of sheets piled up to the south of my stone-cold heels, and Lolita lifted her head and gaped at me. As I learned later from a helpful pharmaceutist, the purple pill did not even belong to the big and noble family of barbiturates. And though it might have induced sleep in a neurotic who believed it to be a potent drug, it was too mild a sedative to affect for any length of time a wary, albeit weary, nymphette. Whether the Ramsdale doctor was a charlatan or a shrewd old rogue does not and did not really matter. What mattered was that I had been deceived. When Lolita opened her eyes again, I realized that whether or not the drug might work later in the night, the security I had relied upon was a sham one. Slowly her head turned away and dropped onto her unfair amount of pillow. I lay quite still on my brink, peering at her rumpled hair, at the glimmer of nymphet flesh, where half a haunch and half a shoulder dimly showed, and trying to gauge the depth of her sleep by the rate of her respiration. Some time passed. Nothing changed, and I decided I might risk getting a little closer to that lovely and maddening glimmer. But hardly had I moved into its warm purlieus than her breathing was suspended, and I had the odious feeling that little Dolores was wide awake and would explode in screams if I touched her with any part of my wretchedness. Please, reader, no matter your exasperation with the tender-hearted, morbidly sensitive, infinitely circumspect hero of my book, do not skip these essential pages. Imagine me. I shall not exist if you do not imagine me. Try to discern the doe in me, trembling in the forest of my own iniquity. Let's even smile a little. After all, there's no harm in smiling. For instance, I almost wrote, for instance, I had no place to rest my head, and a fit of heartburn, they call those fries French, grand Dieu, was added to my discomfort. She was again fast asleep, my nymphette, but still I did not dare launch upon my enchanted voyage. La petite dormeuse, ou l'amant ridicule. Tomorrow I would stuff her with those earlier pills that had so thoroughly numbed her mummy, in the glove compartment or in the Gladstone bag. Should I wait a solid hour and then creep up again? The science of nympholepsy is a precise science. Actual contact would do it in 1 second flat. An interspace of a millimetre would do it in 10. Let us wait. There is nothing louder than an American hotel. And mind you, this was supposed to be a quiet, cosy, old-fashioned, homey place, gracious living and all that stuff. The clatter of the elevator's gate, some 20 yards northeast of my head, but as clearly perceived as if it were inside my left temple, alternated with the banging and booming of the machine's various evolutions, and lasted well beyond midnight. Every now and then, immediately east of my left ear, always assuming I lay on my back, not daring to direct my viler side towards the nebulous haunch of my bedmate, the corridor would brim with cheerful, resonant, and inept exclamations ending in a volley of good nights. When that stopped, a toilet immediately north of my cerebellum took over. It was a manly, energetic, deep-throated toilet, and it was used many times. Its gurgle and gush and long afterflow shook the wall behind me. Then someone in a southern direction was extravagantly sick, almost coughing out his life with his liquor, and his toilet descended like a veritable Niagara immediately beyond our bathroom. And when finally all the waterfalls had stopped, and the enchanted hunters were sound asleep, the avenue under the window of my insomnia, to the west of my wake, a staid, eminently residential, dignified alley of huge trees, degenerated into the despicable haunt of gigantic trucks roaring through the wet and windy night. And less than 6 inches from me, and my burning life, was nebulous Lolita. After a long, stirless vigil, my tentacles moved towards her again, and this time the creak of the mattress did not awake her. I managed to bring my ravenous bulk so close to her that I felt the aura of her bare shoulder like a warm breath upon my cheek. And then she sat up, gasped, muttered with insane rapidity something about boats, tugged at the sheets, and lapsed back into her rich, dark, young unconsciousness. As she tossed within that abundant flow of sleep, recently auburn, at present lunar, her arm struck me across the face. For a second I held her. She freed herself from the shadow of my embrace, doing this not consciously, not violently, not with any personal distaste, but with the neutral, plaintive murmur of a child demanding its natural rest. And again the situation remained the same. Lolita with her curved spine to Humbert, Humbert resting his head on his hand and burning with desire and dyspepsia. The latter necessitated a trip to the bathroom for a draught of water, which is the best medicine I know in my case, except perhaps milk with radishes, and when I re-entered the strange, pale-striped fastness where Lolita's old and new clothes reclined in various attitudes of enchantment on pieces of furniture that seemed vaguely afloat, my impossible daughter sat up and in clear tones demanded a drink too. She took the resilient and cold paper cup in her shadowy hand and gulped down its contents gratefully, her long eyelashes pointing cupward, and then, with an infantile gesture that carried more charm than any carnal caress, little Lolita wiped her lips against my shoulder. She fell back on her pillow, I had subtracted mine while she drank, and was instantly asleep again. I had not dared offer her a second helping of the drug, and had not abandoned hope that the first might still consolidate her sleep. I started to move toward her, ready for any disappointment, knowing I had better wait, but incapable of waiting. My pillow smelled of her hair. I moved toward my glimmering darling, stopping or retreating every time I thought she stirred or was about to stir. A breeze from Wonderland had begun to affect my thoughts, and now they seemed couched in italics, as if the surface reflecting them were wrinkled by a phantasm of that breeze. Time and again my consciousness folded the wrong way. My shuffling body entered the sphere of sleep, shuffled out again, and once or twice I caught myself drifting into a melancholy snore. Mists of tenderness enfolded mountains of longing. Now and then it seemed to me that the enchanted prey was about to meet halfway the enchanted hunter, that her haunch was working its way toward me under the soft sand of a remote and fabulous beach. And then her dimpled dimness would stir, and I would know she was farther away from me than ever. If I dwell at some length on the tremors and gropings of that distant night, it is because I insist upon proving that I am not, and never was, and never could have been, a brutal scoundrel. The gentle and dreamy regions through which I crept were the patrimonies of poets, not crime's prowling ground. Had I reached my goal, my ecstasy would have been all softness, a case of internal combustion of which she would hardly have felt the heat, even if she were wide awake. But I still hoped she might gradually be engulfed in a completeness of stupor that would allow me to taste more than a glimmer of her. And so, in between tentative approximations, with a confusion of perception metamorphosing her into eye spots of moonlight or a fluffy flowering bush, I would dream I regained consciousness, dream I lay in wait. In the first anti-meridian hours, there was a lull in the restless hotel night. Then, around 4, the corridor toilet cascaded and its door banged. A little after 5, a reverberating monologue began to arrive in several installments from some courtyard or parking place. It was not really a monologue, since the speaker stopped every few seconds to listen, presumably, to another fellow, but that other voice did not reach me, and so no real meaning could be derived from the part heard. Its matter-of-fact intonations, however, helped to bring in the dawn, and the room was already suffused with lilac grey when several industrious toilets went to work, one after the other, and the clattering and whining elevator began to rise and take down early risers and downers, and for some minutes I miserably dozed, and Charlotte was a mermaid in a greenish tank, and somewhere in the passage Dr. Boyd said good morning to you in a fruity voice, and the birds were busy in the trees, and then Lolita yawned. Frigid gentlewomen of the jury, I had thought that months, perhaps years, would elapse before I dared to reveal myself to Dolores Hayes. But by 6 she was wide awake, and by 6:15 we were technically lovers. I'm going to tell you something very strange. It was she who seduced me. Upon hearing her first morning yawn, I feigned handsome profiled sleep. I just did not know what to do. Would she be shocked at finding me by her side, and not in some spare bed? Would she collect her clothes and lock herself up in the bathroom? Would she demand to be taken at once to Ramsdale, to her mother's bedside, back to camp? But my Lo was a sportive lassie. I felt her eyes on me. And when she uttered at last that beloved chortling note of hers, I knew her eyes had been laughing. She rolled over to my side, and her warm brown hair came against my collarbone. I gave a mediocre imitation of waking up. We lay quietly. I gently caressed her hair, and we gently kissed. Her kiss, to my delirious embarrassment, had some rather comical refinements of flutter and probe, which made me conclude that she had been coached at an early age by a little lesbian. No Charlie boy could have taught her that. As if to see whether I had had my fill and learned the lesson, she drew away and surveyed me. Her cheekbones were flushed, her full underlip glistened. My dissolution was near. All at once, with a burst of rough glee, the sign of the nymphette, she put her mouth to my ear, but for quite a while my mind could not separate into words the hot thunder of her whisper, and she laughed and brushed the hair off her face and tried again, and gradually the odd sense of living in a brand new, mad new dream world where everything was permissible came over me as I realized what she was suggesting. I answered, I did not know what game she and Charlie had played. "You mean you've never—" Her features twisted into a stare of disgusted incredulity. "You have never—" she started again. I took time out by nuzzling her a little. "Lay off, will you?" she said with a twangy whine, hastily removing her brown shoulder from my lips. It was very curious the way she considered, and kept doing so for a long time, all caresses except kisses on the mouth or the stark act of love, either romantic slosh or abnormal. "You mean," she persisted, now kneeling above me, "you never did it when you were a kid?" "Never," I answered, quite truthfully. "Okay," said Lolita. "Here's where we start." However, I shall not bore my learned readers with a detailed account of Lolita's presumption. Suffice it to say that not a trace of modesty did I perceive in this beautiful, hardly formed young girl whom modern coeducational, juvenile mores, the campfire racket and so forth had utterly and hopelessly depraved. She saw the stark act merely as part of a youngster's furtive world, unknown to adults. What adults did for purposes of procreation was no business of hers. My life was handled by Little Low in an energetic, matter-of-fact manner, as if it were an insensate gadget unconnected with me. While eager to impress me with the world of tough kids, she was not quite prepared for certain discrepancy between a kid's life and mine. Pride alone prevented her from giving up, for in my strange predicament I feigned supreme stupidity and had her have her way, at least while I could still bear it. But really, these are irrelevant matters. I'm not concerned with so-called sex at all. Anybody can imagine those elements of animality. A greater endeavour lures me on, to fix once for all the perilous magic of nymphets. I have to tread carefully. I have to speak in a whisper. Oh, you veteran crime reporter, you grave old usher, you once popular policeman, now in solitary confinement after gracing that school crossing for years, you wretched emeritus read to by a boy, it would never do, would it, to have you fellows fall madly in love with my Lolita. Had I been a painter, had the management of the Enchanted Hunters lost its mind one summer day and commissioned me to redecorate their dining room with murals of my own making, this is what I might have thought up. Let me list some fragments. There would have been a lake. There would have been an arbor in flame flower. There would have been nature studies, a tiger pursuing a bird of paradise, a choking snake sheathing whole the flayed trunk of a shoat. There would have been a sultan, his face expressing great agony, belied as it were by his molding caress, helping a Calipigian slave child to climb a column of onyx. There would have been those luminous globules of gonadal glow that travel up the opalescent sides of jukeboxes. There would have been all kinds of camp activities in the part of the intermediate group, canoeing, curranting, combing curls in the lakeside sun. There would have been poplars, apples, a suburban Sunday. There would have been a fire opal dissolving within a ripple-ringed pool, a last throb, a last dab of colour, stinging red, smarting pink, a sigh, a wincing child. I am trying to describe these things, not to relive them in my present boundless misery, but to sort out the portion of hell and the portion of heaven in that strange, awful, maddening world, nymphet love. The beastly and beautiful merged at one point, and it is that borderline I would like to fix, and I feel I fail to do so utterly. Why? The stipulation of the Roman law, according to which a girl may marry at 12, was adopted by the church and is still preserved rather tacitly in some of the United States. And 15 is lawful everywhere. There is nothing wrong, say both hemispheres, when a brute of 40, blessed by the local priest and bloated with drink, sheds his sweat-drenched finery and thrusts himself up to the hilt into his youthful bride. In such stimulating temperate climates, says an old magazine in this prison library, as St. Louis, Chicago, and Cincinnati, girls mature about the end of their 12th year. Dolores Hayes was born less than 300 miles from stimulating Cincinnati. I have but followed nature. I am nature's faithful hound. Why then this horror that I cannot shake off? Did I deprive her of her flower? Sensitive gentlewomen of the jury, I was not even her first lover. She told me the way she had been debauched. We ate flavourless mealy bananas, bruised peaches and very palatable potato chips, and Decliner told me everything. Her voluble but disjointed account was accompanied by many a droll moue, as I think I have already observed. I especially remembered one wry face on an ugh basis, jelly mouth distended sideways and eyes rolled up in a routine blend of comic disgust, resignation, and tolerance for young frailty. Her astounding tale started with an introductory mention of her tentmate of the previous summer at another camp, a very select one, as she put it. That tentmate, quite a derelict character, half crazy but a swell kid, instructed her in various manipulations. At first, Loyal Low refused to tell me her name. Was it Grace Angel? I asked. She shook her head. No, it wasn't. It was the daughter of a big shot. Was it perhaps Rose Carmine? No, of course not. Her father. Was it then Agnes Sheridan, perchance? She swallowed and shook her head, and then did a double take. Say, how come you know all those kids? I explained. Well, she said, they are pretty bad, some of that school bunch, but not that bad. If you have to know, her name was Elizabeth Talbot. She goes now to a swanky private school. Her father is an executive. I recalled with a funny pang the frequency with which poor Charlotte used to introduce into party chat such elegant tidbits as, when my daughter was out hiking last year with the Talbot girl, I wanted to know if either mother had learned of those sapphic diversions. Gosh, no, exhaled Limp Low, mimicking dread and relief, pressing a falsely fluttering hand to her chest. I was more interested, however, in heterosexual experience. She had entered the sixth grade at 11, soon after moving to Ramsdale from the Middle West. What did she mean by pretty bad? Well, the Miranda twins had shared the same bed for years, and Donald Scott, who was the dumbest boy in the school, had done it with Hazel Smith in his uncle's garage, and Kenneth Knight, who was the brightest, used to examine himself wherever and whenever he had the chance. And let us switch to Camp Q, I said. And presently I got the whole story. Barbara Burke, a sturdy blonde, 2 years older than Lowe, and by far the camp's best swimmer, had a very special canoe, which she shared with Lowe, because I was the only other girl who could make Willow Island, some swimming test, I imagine. Through July, every morning, mark, reader, every blessed morning, Barbara and Lowe would be helped to carry the boat to Onyx or Eryx, two small lakes in the wood, by Charlie Holmes, the camp mistress's son, aged 13, and the only human male for a couple of miles around, excepting an old, meek, stone-deaf handyman and a farmer in an old Ford who sometimes sold the campers eggs, as farmers will. Every morning, oh my reader, the three children would take a shortcut through the beautiful innocent forest, brimming with all the emblems of youth, dew, bird songs, and at one point, among the luxuriant undergrowth, Lowe would be left a sentinel while Barbara and the boy copulated behind a bush. At first, Lowe had refused to try what it was like, but curiosity and camaraderie prevailed, and soon she and Barbara were doing it by turns with the silent, coarse and surly but indefatigable Charlie, who had as much sex appeal as a raw carrot, but sported a fascinating collection of contraceptives, which he used to fish out of the third nearby lake, a considerably larger and more populous one called Lake Climax, after the booming young factory town of that name. Although conceding it was sort of fun and fine for the complexion, Lolita, I am glad to say, held Charlie's mind and manners in the greatest contempt. Nor had her temperament been roused by that filthy fiend. In fact, I think he had rather stunned it, despite the fun. By that time, it was close to 10. With the ebb of lust, an ashen sense of awfulness abetted by the realistic drabness of a grey neuralgic day crept over me and hummed within my temples. Brown, naked, frail Low, her narrow white buttocks to me, her sulky face to a door mirror, stood, arms akimbo, feet in new slippers with pussy fur tops wide apart, and through a forehanging lock tritely mugged at herself in the glass. From the corridor came the cooing voices of coloured maids at work, and presently there was a mild attempt to open the door of our room. I had Lowe go to the bathroom and take a much-needed soap shower. The bed was a frightful mess with overtones of potato chips. She tried on a two-piece navy wool, then a sleeveless blouse with a swirly clathrate skirt. But the first was too tight and the second too ample, and when I begged her to hurry up, the situation was beginning to frighten me, Lowe viciously sent those nice presents of mine hurtling into a corner and put on yesterday's dress. When she was ready at last, I gave her a lovely new purse of simulated calf, in which I had slipped quite a few pennies and two mint-bright dimes, and told her to buy herself a magazine in the lobby. "I'll be down in a minute," I said. "And if I were you, my dear, I wouldn't talk to strangers." Except for my poor little gifts, there was not much to pack. But I was forced to devote a dangerous amount of time, was she up to something downstairs, to arranging the bed in such a way as to suggest the abandonedness of a restless father and his tomboy daughter, instead of an ex-convict saturnalia with a couple of fat old whores. Then I finished dressing and had the hoary bellboy come up for the bags. Everything was fine. There in the lobby she sat, deep in an overstuffed blood-red armchair, deep in a lurid movie magazine. A fellow of my age in tweeds, The genre of the place had changed overnight to a spurious country squire atmosphere, was staring at my Lolita over his dead cigar and stale newspaper. She wore her professional white socks and saddle Oxfords, and that bright print frock with the square throat. A splash of jaded lamplight brought out the golden down on her warm brown limbs. There she sat, her legs carelessly high-crossed, and her pale eyes skimming along the lines with every now and then a blink. Bill's wife had worshipped him from afar long before they ever met. In fact, she used to secretly admire the famous young actor as he ate Sundays in Schwab's drugstore. Nothing could have been more childish than her snub nose, freckled face, or the purplish spot on her naked neck where a fairy-tale vampire had feasted, or the unconscious movement of her tongue exploring a touch of rosy rash around her swollen lips. Nothing could be more harmless than to read about Jill, an energetic starlet who made her own clothes and was a student of serious literature. Nothing could be more innocent than the part of that glossy brown hair with that silky sheen on the temple. Nothing could be more naive. But what sickening envy the lecherous fellow, whoever he was. Come to think of it, he resembled a little my Swiss Uncle Gustav, also a great admirer of Le Découvert, would have experienced had he known that every nerve in me was still anointed and ringed with the feel of her body, the body of some immortal daemon disguised as a female child. Was Pink Pig Mr. Swoon absolutely sure my wife had not telephoned? He was. If she did, would he tell her we had gone to Aunt Claire's place? He would indeedy. I settled the bill and roused Lo from her chair. She read to the car. Still reading, she was driven to a so-called coffee shop a few blocks south. Oh, she ate all right. She even laid aside her magazine to eat. But a queer dullness had replaced her usual cheerfulness. I knew little Lo could be very nasty, so I braced myself and grinned and waited for a squall. I was unbathed, unshaven, and had had no bowel movement. My nerves were a jangle. I did not like the way my little mistress shrugged her shoulders and distended her nostrils when I attempted casual small talk. "Had Phyllis been in the know before she joined her parents in Maine?" I asked with a smile. "Look," said Lo, making a weeping grimace. "Let us get off the subject." I then tried, also unsuccessfully, no matter how I smacked my lips, to interest her in the road map. Our destination was, let me remind my patient reader, whose meek temper Lo ought to have copied, the gay town of Leppingville, somewhere near a hypothetical hospital. The destination was in itself a perfectly arbitrary one, as alas so many were to be, and I shook in my shoes as I wondered how to keep the whole arrangement plausible, and what other plausible objectives to invent after we had taken in all the movies in Leppingville. More and more uncomfortable did Humbert feel. It was something quite special, that feeling. An oppressive, hideous constraint, as if I was sitting with the small ghost of somebody I had just killed. As she was in the act of getting back into the car, an expression of pain flitted across Lo's face. It flitted again, more meaningfully, as she settled down beside me. No doubt she reproduced it that second time for my benefit. Foolishly, I asked her what was the matter. "Nothing, you brute," she replied. "You what?" I asked. She was silent. Leaving Bryceland, loquacious Lo was silent. Cold spiders of panic crawled down my back. This was an orphan. This was a lone child, an absolute waif with whom a heavy-limbed, foul-smelling adult had had strenuous intercourse three times that very morning. Whether or not the realization of a lifelong dream had surpassed all expectation, it had, in a sense, overshot its mark and plunged into a nightmare. I had been careless, stupid, and ignoble. And let me be quite frank, somewhere at the bottom of that dark turmoil I felt the writhing of desire again, so monstrous was my appetite for that miserable nymphette. Mingled with the pangs of guilt was the agonizing thought that her mood might prevent me from making love to her again as soon as I found a nice country road where to park in peace. In other words, poor Humbert Humbert was dreadfully unhappy. And while steadily and inanely driving toward Leppingville, he kept racking his brains for some quip under the bright wing of which he might dare turn to his seatmate. It was she, however, who broke the silence. "Oh, a squash squirrel," she said. "What a shame." "Yes, isn't it?" Eager, hopeful hum. "Let us stop at the next gas station," Lowe continued. "I want to go to the washroom." "We shall stop wherever you want," I said. And then, as a lovely, lonely, supercilious grove, oaks, I thought, American trees at that stage were beyond me, started to echo greenly the rush of our car. A red and ferny road on our right turned its head before slanting into the woodland, and I suggested we might perhaps drive on, my low cried shrilly. Righto, take it easy. Down, poor beast, down. I glanced at her. Thank God the child was smiling. "You chump," she said, sweetly smiling at me. "You revolting creature. I was a daisy-fresh girl, and look what you've done to me. I ought to call the police and tell them you raped me. Oh, you dirty, dirty old man." Was she just joking? An ominous hysterical note rang through her silly words. Presently, making a sizzling sound with her lips, she started complaining of pains, said she could not sit, said I'd torn something inside her. A sweat rolled down my neck, and we almost ran over some little animal or other that was crossing the road with tail erect, and again my vile-tempered companion called me an ugly name. When we stopped at the filling station, she scrambled out without a word, and was a long time away. Slowly, lovingly, an elderly friend with a broken nose wiped my windshield. They do it differently at every place, from chamois cloth to soapy brush. This fellow used a pink sponge. She appeared at last. "Look," she said in that neutral voice that hurt me so, "give me some dimes and nickels. I want to call Mother in that hospital. What's the number?" "Get in," I said. "You can't call that number." "Why?" "Get in and slam the door." She got in and slammed the door. The old garage man beamed at her. I swung onto the highway. "Why can't I call my mother if I want to?" "Because," I answered, "your mother is dead." In the gay town of Leppingville, I bought her 4 books of comics, a box of candy, a box of sanitary pads, 2 Cokes, a manicure set, a travel clock with a luminous dial, a ring with a real topaz, a tennis racket, roller skates with white high shoes, field glasses, a portable radio set, chewing gum, a transparent raincoat, sunglasses, some more garments, swooners, shorts, all kinds of summer frocks. At the hotel, we had separate rooms. But in the middle of the night she came sobbing into mine, and we made it up very gently. You see, she had absolutely nowhere else to go. It was then that began our extensive travels all over the States. To any other type of tourist accommodation, I soon grew to prefer the functional motel. Clean, neat, safe nooks, ideal places for sleep, argument, reconciliation, insatiable illicit love. At first, in my dread of arousing suspicion, I would eagerly pay for both sections of one double unit, each containing a double bed. I wondered what type of foursome this arrangement was ever intended for, since only a pharisaic parity of privacy could be attained by means of the incomplete partition dividing the cabin or room into 2 communicating love nests. By and by, the very possibilities that such honest promiscuity suggested, 2 young couples merrily swapping mates, or a child shamming sleep to ear witness primal sonorities, made me bolder, and every now and then I would take a bed and cot, or twin bed cabin, a prison cell of paradise, with yellow window shades pulled down to create a morning illusion of Venice and sunshine, when actually it was Pennsylvania and rain. We came to know, nous connûmes, to use a Flaubertian intonation, the stone cottages under enormous Chateaubriand-esque trees, the brick unit, the adobe unit, the stucco court. On what the tour book of the Automobile Association describes as shaded or spacious or landscaped grounds. The log kind, finished in knotty pine, reminded Low, by its golden-brown glaze, of fried chicken bones. We held in contempt the plain whitewashed clapboard cabins with their faint sewerish smell or some other gloomy self-conscious stench, and nothing to boast of except good beds and an unsmiling landlady always prepared to have her gift, well, I could give you, turned down. Nous connûmes, this is royal fun, the would-be enticements of their repetitious names, all those sunset motels, U-beam cottages, Hillcrest courts, Pine View courts, Mountain View courts, Skyline courts, Park Plaza courts, Green Acres, Max courts. There was sometimes a special line in the write-up, such as, children welcome, pets allowed, you are welcome, you are allowed. The baths were mostly tiled showers, with an endless variety of spouting mechanisms, but with one definitely non-Laodicean characteristic in common, a propensity, while in use, to turn instantly beastly hot or blindingly cold upon you, depending on whether your neighbour turned on his cold or his hot to deprive you of a necessary compliment in the shower you had so carefully blended. Some motels had instructions pasted above the toilet, on whose tank the towels were unhygienically heaped, asking guests not to throw into its bowl garbage, beer cans, cartons, stillborn babies. Others had special notices under glass, such as things to do. Riding. You will often see riders coming down the main street on their way back from a romantic moonlight ride. Yeah, often at 3 a.m, sneered unromantic Low. Nukonum, the various types of motor court operators, the reformed criminal, the retired teacher and the business flop among the males, and the motherly, pseudo-ladylike and madamic variants among the females. And sometimes trains would cry in the monstrously hot and humid night with heart-rending and ominous plangency, mingling power and hysteria in one desperate scream. We avoided tourist homes, country cousins of funeral ones, old-fashioned, genteel and showerless, with elaborate dressing tables in depressingly white and pink little bedrooms, and photographs of the landlady's children in all their instars. But I did surrender now and then to Lowe's predilection for real hotels. She would pick out in the book, while I petted her in the parked car in the silence of a dusk-mellowed, mysterious side road, some highly recommended lake lodge which offered all sorts of things magnified by the flashlight she moved over them, such as congenial company, between meals snacks, outdoor barbecues, but which in my mind conjured up odious visions of stinking high school boys in sweatshirts and an ember-red cheek pressing against hers while poor Dr. Humbert, embracing nothing but two masculine knees, would cold-humour his piles on the damp turf. Most tempting to her, too, were these colonial inns, which apart from gracious atmosphere and picture windows promised unlimited quantities of food. Treasured recollections of my father's palatial hotel sometimes led me to seek for its like in the strange country we travelled through. I was soon discouraged. But Lowe kept following the scent of rich food ads, while I derived a not exclusively economic kick from such roadside signs as Timber Hotel, Children Under 14 Free. On the other hand, I shudder when recalling that soi-disant high-class resort in a Midwestern state which advertised, "Raid the icebox, midnight stacks," and, intrigued by my accent, wanted to know my dead wife's and my dead mother's maiden names. A 2 days' stay there cost me $124. And do you remember, Miranda, the other ultra-smart robber's den with complimentary morning coffee and circulating ice water and no children under 16? No Lolitas, of course? Immediately upon arrival at one of the plainer motor courts which became our habitual haunts, she would set the electric fan awhir or induce me to drop a quarter into the radio, and she would read all the signs and inquire with a whine why she could not go riding up some advertised trail or swimming in that local pool of warm mineral water. Most often, in the slouching, bored way she cultivated, Lowe would fall prostrate and abominably desirable into the red spring chair or a green chaise longue, or a steamer chair of striped canvas with footrest and canopy, or a sling chair, or any other lawn chair under the garden umbrella on the patio, and it would take hours of blandishments, threats, and promises to make her lend me for a few seconds her brown limbs in the seclusion of the $5 room before undertaking anything she might prefer to my poor joy. A combination of naivete and deception, of charm and vulgarity, of blue sulks and rosy mirth, Lolita, when she chose, could be a most exasperating brat. I was not really quite prepared for her fits of disorganized boredom, intense and vehement griping, her sprawling, droopy, dopey-eyed style, and what is called goofing off, a kind of diffused clowning which she thought was tough in a boyish hoodlum way. Mentally, I found her to be a disgustingly conventional little girl. Sweet hot jazz, square dancing, gooey fudge sundaes, musicals, movie magazines and so forth, these were the obvious items in her list of beloved things. The Lord knows how many nickels I fed to the gorgeous music boxes that came with every meal we had. I still hear the nasal voices of those invisibles serenading her, people with names like Sammy and Joe, Eddie and Tony, and Peggy and Guy, and Patty and Rex, and sentimental song hits, all of them as similar to my ear as her various candies were to my palate. She believed with a kind of celestial trust any advertisement or advice that appeared in Movie Love or Screenland. Staracil starves pimples, or You better watch out if you're wearing your shirt tails outside your jeans, girls, because Jill says you shouldn't. If a roadside sign said, "Visit our gift shop," we had to visit it, had to buy its Indian curios, dolls, copper jewelry, cactus candy. The words novelties and souvenirs simply entranced her by their trochaic lilt. If some cafe sign proclaimed ice-cold drinks, she was automatically stirred, although all drinks everywhere were ice-cold. She it was to whom ads were dedicated, the ideal consumer, the subject and object of every foul poster, and she attempted, unsuccessfully, to patronize only those restaurants where the holy spirit of Hunkin' Dines had descended upon the cute paper napkins and cottage cheese-crested salads. In those days, neither she nor I had thought up yet the system of monetary bribes which was to work such havoc with my nerves and her morals somewhat later. I relied on three other methods to keep my pubescent concubine in submission and passable temper. A few years before, she had spent a rainy summer under Miss Phelan's bleary eye in a dilapidated Appalachian farmhouse that had belonged to some gnarled Hayes or other in the dead past. It still stood among its rank acres of goldenrod on the edge of a flowerless forest, at the end of a permanently muddy road, 20 miles from the nearest hamlet. Lowe recalled that scarecrow of a house, the solitude, the soggy old pastures, the wind, the bloated wilderness, with an energy of disgust that distorted her mouth and fattened her half-revealed tongue. And it was there that I warned her she would dwell with me in exile for months and years, if need be, studying under me French and Latin, unless her present attitude changed. "Charlotte, I began to understand you." A simple child, Lowe would scream no and frantically clutch at my driving hand whenever I put a stop to her tornadoes of temper by turning in the middle of a highway with the implication that I was about to take her straight to that dark and dismal abode. The farther, however, we travelled away from it west, the less tangible that menace became, and I had to adopt other methods of persuasion. Among these, the reformatory threat is the one I recall with the deepest moan of shame. From the very beginning of our concourse, I was clever enough to realize that I must secure her complete cooperation in keeping our relations secret, that it should become a second nature to her, no matter what grudge she might bear me, no matter what other pleasures she might seek. "Come and kiss your old man," I would say, "and drop that moody nonsense. In former times, when I was still your dream male," the reader will notice what pains I took to speak Lowe's language, "you swoon to records of the number one throb-and-sob idol of your coevals." Lowe: "And my what? Speak English. That idol of your pals sounded, you thought, like friend Humbert. But now I am just your old man, a dream dad protecting his dream daughter. My chère Dolores, I want to protect you, dear, from all the horrors that happen to little girls in coal sheds and alleyways, and alas, comme vous le savez trop bien, mon gentil, in the blueberry woods during the bluest of summers. Through thick and thin I will stay your guardian, and if you are good, I hope a court may legalize that guardianship before long. Let us, however, forget Dolores Hayes, so-called legal terminology, terminology that accepts as rational the term lewd and lascivious cohabitation. I am not a criminal sexual psychopath taking indecent liberties with a child. The rapist was Charlie Holmes. I am the therapist, a matter of nice spacing in the way of distinction. I am your dadum, though. Look, I've a learned book here about young girls. Now look, darling, what it says. I quote, "The normal girl," normal, mark you, "the normal girl is usually extremely anxious to please her father. She feels in him the forerunner of the desired elusive male." Elusive is good by Bolognese. "The wise mother," and your poor mother would have been wise had she lived, "will encourage a companionship between father and daughter, realizing, excuse the corny style, that the girl forms her ideals of romance and of men from her association with her father." Now, what association does this cheery book mean and recommend? I quote again. "Among Sicilians, sexual relations between a father and his daughter are accepted as a matter of course, and the girl who participates in such a relationship is not looked upon with disapproval by the society of which she is a part. I'm a great admirer of Sicilians, fine athletes, fine musicians, fine, upright people, though, and great lovers. But let's not digress. Only the other day we read in the newspaper some bunkum about a middle-aged morals offender who pleaded guilty to the violation of the Mann Act and to transporting a 9-year-old girl across state lines for immoral purposes, whatever these are. Dolores, darling, you are not 9, but almost 13, and I would not advise you to consider yourself my cross-country slave, and I deplore the man act as lending itself to a dreadful pun, the revenge that the gods of semantics take against tight-zippered Philistines. I am your father, and I am speaking English, and I love you. Finally, let us see what happens if you, a minor, accused of having impaired the morals of an adult in a respectable inn, what happens if you complain to the police of my having kidnapped and raped you? Let us suppose they believe you. A minor female, who allows a person over 21 to know her carnally, involves her victim into statutory rape or second-degree sodomy, depending on the technique, and the maximum penalty is 10 years. So, I go to jail. Okay, I go to jail. But what happens to you, my orphan? Well, you are luckier. You become the ward of the Department of Public Welfare, which I'm afraid sounds a little bleak. A nice grim matron of the Miss Phelan type, but more rigid and not a drinking woman, will take away your lipstick and fancy clothes. No more gadding about. I don't know if you've ever heard of the laws relating to dependent, neglected, incorrigible, delinquent children, but while I stand gripping the bars, you, happy neglected child, will be given a choice of various dwelling places, all more or less the same, the correctional school, the reformatory, the juvenile detention home, or one of those admirable girls' protectories where you knit things and sing hymns and have rancid pancakes on Sundays. You will go there, Lolita. My Lolita. This Lolita will leave her Catullus and go there, as the wayward girl you are. In plainer words, if we two are found out, you will be analysed and institutionalised, my pet. C'est tout. You will dwell, my Lolita will dwell, come here, my brown flower, with 39 other dopes in a dirty dormitory. No, allow me, please. Under the supervision of hideous matrons. This is the situation. This is the choice. Don't you think that under the circumstances, Dolores Hayes had better stick to her old man? By rubbing all this in, I succeeded in terrorizing Lo, who, despite a certain brash alertness of manner and spurts of wit, was not as intelligent a child as her IQ might suggest. But if I managed to establish that background of shared secrecy and shared guilt, I was much less successful in keeping her in good humor. Every morning during our year-long travels, I had to devise some expectation, some special point in space and time for her to look forward to, for her to survive till bedtime. Otherwise deprived of a shaping and sustaining purpose, the skeleton of her day sagged and collapsed. The object in view might be anything, a lighthouse in Virginia, a natural cave in Arkansas converted to a cafe, a collection of guns and violins somewhere in Oklahoma, a replica of the Grotto of Lourdes in Louisiana, shabby photographs of the Bonanza mining period in the local museum of a Rocky Mountains resort, anything whatsoever, but it had to be there in front of us like a fixed star, although as likely as not, Lo would feign gagging as soon as we got to it. By putting the geography of the United States into motion, I did my best for hours on end to give her the impression of going places, of rolling on to some definite destination, to some unusual delight. I have never seen such smooth, amiable roads as those that now radiated before us, across the crazy quilt of 48 states. Voraciously we consumed these long highways, in rapt silence we glided over their glossy black dance floors. Not only had Lo no eye for scenery, but she furiously resented my calling her attention to this or that enchanting detail of landscape, which I myself learned to discern only after being exposed for quite a time to the delicate beauty ever present in the margin of our undeserving journey. By a paradox of pictorial thought, the average lowland North American countryside had at first seemed to me something I accepted with a shock of amused recognition because of those painted oilcloths which were imported from America in the old days to be hung above washstands in central European nurseries, and which fascinated a drowsy child at bedtime with the rustic green views they depicted. Opaque curly trees, a barn, cattle, a brook, the dull white of vague orchards in bloom, and perhaps a stone fence or hills of greenish gouache. But gradually the models of those elementary rusticities became stranger and stranger to the eye the nearer I came to know them. Beyond the tilled plain, beyond the toy roofs, there would be a slow suffusion of inutile loveliness, a low sun in a platinum haze with a warm peeled peach tinge pervading the upper edge of a two-dimensional dove-grey cloud fusing with the distant amorous mist. There might be a line of spaced trees silhouetted against the horizon, and hot still noons above a wilderness of clover, and Claude Lorraine clouds inscribed remotely into misty azure, with only their cumulus part conspicuous against the neutral swoon of the background. Or again, it might be a stern El Greco horizon, pregnant with inky rain, and a passing glimpse of some mummy-necked farmer, and all around alternating strips of quicksilverish water and harsh green corn, the whole arrangement opening like a fan somewhere in Kansas. Now and then, in the vastness of those plains, huge trees would advance towards us to cluster self-consciously by the roadside and provide a bit of humanitarian shade above a picnic table, with sunflecks, flattened paper cups, samaras and discarded ice cream sticks littering the brown ground. A great user of roadside facilities, my unfastidious low would be charmed by toilet signs. Guys, gals, John Jane, Jack Jill, and even Bucks Does. While, lost in an artist's dream, I would stare at the honest brightness of the gasoline paraphernalia against the splendid green of oaks, or at a distant hill scrambling out, scarred but still untamed, from the wilderness of agriculture that was trying to swallow it. At night, tall trucks studded with coloured lights, like dreadful giant Christmas trees, loomed in the darkness and thundered by the belated little sedan. And again next day, a thinly populated sky, losing its blue to the heat, would melt overhead, and Lo would clamour for a drink, and her cheeks would hollow vigorously over the straw, and the car inside would be a furnace when we got in again, and the road shimmered ahead with a remote car changing its shape mirage-like in the surface glare, and seeming to hang for a moment, old-fashionedly square and high, in the hot haze. And as we pushed westward, patches of what the garage man called sagebrush appeared, and then the mysterious outlines of table-like hills, and then red bluffs ink-blotted with junipers, and then a mountain range dun grading into blue, and blue into dream, and the desert would meet us with a steady gale, dust-grey thorn bushes and hideous bits of tissue paper mimicking pale flowers among the prickles of wind-tortured withered stalks all along the highway, in the middle of which there sometimes stood simple cows, immobilized in a position, tail left, white eyelashes right, cutting across all human rules of traffic. My lawyer has suggested I give a clear, frank account of the itinerary we followed, and I suppose I have reached here a point where I cannot avoid that chore. Roughly during that mad year, August 1947 to August 1948, our route began with a series of wiggles and whirls in New England, then meandered south, up and down, east and west, dipped deep into ce qu'on appelle Dixieland, avoided Florida because the Farlows were there, veered west, zigzagged through corn belts and cotton belts. This is not too clear, I'm afraid, Clarence, but I did not keep any notes and have at my disposal only an atrociously crippled tour book in three volumes, almost a symbol of my torn and tattered past in which to check these recollections. Crossed and recrossed the Rockies, straggled through southern deserts where we wintered, reached the Pacific, turned north through the pale lilac fluff of flowering shrubs along forest roads, almost reached the Canadian border, and proceeded east, across good lands and bad lands, back to agriculture on a grand scale, avoiding, despite Little Lowe's strident remonstrations, Little Lowe's birthplace, in a corn, coal and hog-producing area, and finally returned to the fold of the east, petering out in the college town of Beardsley.